So basically, we will discuss this in the cosmology lecture. Roughly speaking, what you do is you take the cosmic time, which, let's for example take the time at the electroweak phase transition, 100 GeV temperature, very high temperature in the early universe. That is 10 to the minus 10 seconds. So the characteristic scale there is the time. It's just the speed of light times 10 to the minus 10 seconds. So that would be, you know, a centimeter, 3 centimeters. Okay, but you take the scale then, which is 3 centimeters. Sorry, have I got that right? Yeah, that's right. 10 to the minus 10 seconds, and I take 3 times 10 to the 8. So I get 3 times 10 to the minus 2 meters. So the wavelength at that time was 3 centimeters of the horizon scale, T. And then we expand that by how much expansion the universe has undergone since then. The temperature then was 100 GeV. The temperature today is a milli electron volt. So it has expanded by about 10 to the, let's see, 100 GeV means 10 to the 11 EV. Divide by a milli electron volt, it's about 10 to the 14. So take this wavelength and multiply by 10 to the 14. Okay, so the horizon scale then is represents 10 to the 12 meters today. It is a very big scale. So that you would have to study using astronomical measurements. But it turns out you're interested in scales much smaller than that, because you're interested in scales, first of all, when the shocks form, which is down by 10 to the minus 4. And then actually you're interested in the structures on the scale of the width of the shocks. When they collide, they make things. So, you know, it comes down. And that's electroweak times. If I go back earlier times, I get shorter wavelengths. So there's no doubt there would be something in the window, any window they can measure. Okay, I think I better, yeah, go ahead. That's a good question. The dispersion is caused by viscosity. If you have a fluid, the fundamental reason is diffusion. You know, if I have a fluid where the scattering length is tiny and the mean free path is tiny, essentially it behaves like a perfect fluid with no viscosity. When you have diffusion, you know, if you have a sound wave and the particles diffuse out of the peaks, that's what dissipates the wave. So diffusion, viscosity, you know, they're all related. Turns out in the early universe, the mean free path of the particles is absolutely minuscule. It's determined by the temperature, which is an inverse temperature, is a tiny scale. But the horizon size is very large. So the diffusion at this sort of time is completely negligible. The fluid behaves like an absolutely perfect fluid with no viscosity. So the damping is almost nothing. Good question. Okay, I better do what I'm supposed to be doing. let us. Okay, so last time we studied gravitational waves and how they were generated. And I think I've indicated several times, this is really an amazing window on the universe, because it will take us back. It will allow us to see black holes, all the nonlinear stuff going on in black hole collisions. It will allow us to see the Big Bang, because these gravitational waves propagate freely through the hot early universe. And using gravitational waves, you can literally look and see what happened at the Big Bang. I mean, and everything in between. So gravitational waves are the new frontier. And in the next, we expect in the next 5 years, fairly confidently, that there will be announcements of the detection of gravitational waves for the first time from black hole encounters and neutron stars and so on. So that's really just the beginning. But what I'm going to discuss today is the simplest solution of the Einstein equations. Of the vacuum Einstein equations. So this is the equations in the absence of any matter. R mu nu equals zero. And this is the analog of the Coulomb electric field. Okay, so the Coulomb electric field, it sort of doesn't quite solve div E equals zero because you have a charge source. But in gravity, there's a solution even without a source. In a sense, there'll be a source. But we're interested in the gravitational field outside the source, and that which would be the analog of the Coulomb potential, or Coulomb field in electrostatics. Okay, so the first assumption is spherical symmetry. Okay, and that's an incredibly strong assumption, actually, because it turns out there are black hole solutions that are not spherically symmetric. They're rotating, but spherical symmetry is the easiest case. So spherical symmetry means that the metric, or the line element, depends only on rotational invariance. Okay, so in order to implement spherical symmetry, you have to decide how your coordinates transform under spherical under rotations, and you then write down the line element, which is invariant. So the rotations just do this, where O is a 3x3 rotation matrix. Okay, O transpose O equals 1. O is a rotation matrix. And the question is, what can we write down which will be obviously invariant under those rotations? Well, for a start, the time doesn't transform under rotations. So we can write any function of time. We can write dt that doesn't depend on rotations. We can write down r squared, which is x dot x. That's independent of rotations. And we can write the derivative of r squared, which is r dr, which is x dot dx. That's also invariant under rotations. So we can write dr for sure. And then finally, we can write dx squared, which you know from spherical geometry, the metric in flat space is just r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So these are the spherical polos. Okay, and we know that's also invariant because dx goes to O times dx. Okay, all these things are invariant. So we'll call this thing d omega 2 squared. It's the line element on a two-sphere on S2, just to keep the notation simple. So when I write down a line element, these are the only things I can include. There's nothing else that will be rotational invariant. Any function of t, any function of r, and then I must use these invariants to write the metric down. So the line element would be dl squared, which will be minus c dt squared plus, let's see, I've chosen minus 2d dr dt plus e dr squared plus f r squared d omega 2 squared, okay, where c, d, e, and f are functions of t and r. Okay, so that line element is rotationally invariant. And it's easy to see it has a number of killing vectors. Every rotation has a corresponding killing vector. So in this case, there are three independent rotations in three dimensions. So there are three killing vectors of this line element. And there will turn out to be more when we write the full metric. So let's now try to simplify. By redefining r prime to be such that this coefficient is r prime squared, square root of f r. Okay, that's fine. That's a new coordinate, r prime, which is a function of r and t. And if I choose this coordinate, it changes this coefficient to r prime squared. Okay? Of course, it will mess all of this up because dr prime will now include a dr and a dt. And when I square, when I solve for dr, I'm going to re-express all of this in terms of dr prime. But messing it up doesn't matter because these were arbitrary anyway. Okay? So what we get is that dl squared is equal to minus c dt squared plus minus. So, and then I'm going to delete the primes. Okay, so I'm just going to redefine this to be r prime, and then I'll call it r again. It really doesn't make any difference because I'm going to do it several times. I don't want to keep track of all the times I'm doing it, plus r squared d omega 2 squared with some new c d e. Actually, I think it's, yes, no, it'll be, everything will be changed. So when I solve for dr in terms of dr prime, the dr is going to include some dt. And squaring it, you're going to get contributions to this and this as well as this. So you'll just change all those coefficients, but it doesn't matter since they were arbitrary anyway. Okay, so that's the step one to simplify. We've got rid of one of these arbitrary functions. The second step is to get rid of this off-diagonal term. That's a sort of slightly uglier term. If we get rid of it, we'll be in the nice situation that we can read off the eigenvalues immediately and tell when the eigenvalues are, you know, we want minus, plus, plus, plus. And if it's diagonal, that's easy to read off. So let us remove d by setting dt prime. So we want to redefine the time coordinate to get rid of d. Dt prime is some function of t and r times c dt plus d dr. Okay, why do I do that? Because if I do this, then dt prime squared is equal to f squared times c squared dt squared plus 2cd dr dt plus d squared dr squared. And you notice that this term here is precisely what I have over here. Okay? So then I can say that dl squared is equal to minus f squared minus dt prime squared over f squared, right? That'll give the whole thing inside the bracket. And then I've got to correct this term. So plus d squared dr squared. And then I've got plus edr squared over there. So let's combine that. Dr squared, okay, plus r squared d omega 2 squared. Okay, so that's very nice. Now I've just got rid of the off-diagonal term. The question is whether this is a legitimate thing to do. Can I find a t prime such that this equation is true? Now remember, c and d we're assuming were given. They're some given functions of r and t. This was arbitrary. F was arbitrary. Okay, so the question is, am I able to find an f such that dt prime is given by this expression? Now the only obstacle to doing so, is the fact that, the only obstacle is that this dt prime must be equal to d by dt, partial d by dt of t prime of r, t prime of t and r times dt, okay, plus dr of t prime of t and r dr. Okay, if t prime is a function of t and r, then the derivative dt prime is equal to the partial derivative of t prime with respect to t times dt plus the partial derivative of t prime with respect to r times dr. Okay, and so the question amounts to, can I solve these equations? Can I solve dt t prime equals f times c, and dr t prime equals f times d, okay, for some f. Okay, and remember, f is arbitrary. Now, it's not necessarily true that you can solve those equations, because there is an important consistency condition. The consistency requires that dr dt t prime should equal dt dr of t prime. Right, because partial derivatives commute. So if this function t prime exists, it has to be that the partial derivatives commute. Now, the left-hand side, I can write by differentiating the first equation, if we call this first, the one, and the right-hand side by differentiating the second equation. So the left-hand side becomes dr of fc, and the right-hand side becomes dt of fd. Okay? And this is the differential equation for f. So the question is, does this differential equation for f have solutions for any given c and d? Right? So does this have solutions for F for arbitrary given C and D. Everything being a function of T and R. So for example, you see, if I tried to put F equals 1, if I hadn't put F in there, it would be a disaster. I would just get that consistency requires that the R derivative of C is the T derivative of D, and there's no reason why that should be true. And then there would be I can't find a T prime satisfying this equation. But I have this freedom in F. And it's easy to see there is a solution. Why? The answer is yes, locally, because assume sum F of 0 and R. This is the T argument. Assume you've got some function of T and R. Assume that you're given its value at time 0. For example, you could pick 1. F could be 1 at t equals 0 for all r. So there is some ambiguity about f. This is a PDE. It doesn't completely fix f, but you just want to say there is a solution for f. So assume some f0r, and then this equation star gives you dt f. Okay, so what it'll give you is just solving for dt f. So I'm going to get dt f times d plus f times dt d equals dr of fc. So pull this over to the right-hand side and divide by d minus f comma t d f d comma t over d, right? Divide by d. So the equation determines the time derivative of f. So this equation obviously gives you dt of f t r at t equals 0. Right? In terms of things you already know. You know f, and you know these functions c and d. Okay, well, that's pretty good. But I can use the equation again. I just differentiate again. Gives me dt squared f equals stuff involving f comma t, f, c, d, etc., right, and their derivatives. And I can just repeat the argument. So the equation itself determines each time derivative in terms of things I already know. And so obviously, so iterate to get the Taylor series for f of t and r. Okay, so you have a differential equation which for any given f0 of r will determine f of t of r as a Taylor series. Okay, so at least within the radius of convergence of that series, you know that the solution exists. So that's a nice trick, and it assures you that you're able to locally, at least, remove this term. Yes?
I think in the DS, but there's a C missing in the denominator and the T prime.
Yes. Oh, you're right. Absolutely right. Thank you. Just here? Oh, here? Oh. Thank you. And probably one there too, right?
Yeah, one there.
One there too. Because this is linear in C. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so now we've done these coordinate transformation. We've removed two of these arbitrary functions, A of R and T, the R squared, plus B of R and T, Sorry, why am I writing this? dt squared. In fact, I'm going to write it as t and r dt squared plus b of t and r dr squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared. Okay, so we really haven't used anything so far apart from spherical symmetry. And we've shown the metric only has two arbitrary functions. Now, by the way, this choice of coordinates, or foliation, it's referred to as a foliation of space-time because coordinate surfaces are hyperplanes, let's say, which divide up space-time into boxes or a grid. And it's easy to see what this foliation is. So this choice of radial coordinates means that the area of the constant r constant t surface. So if I fix r, that means I'm not measuring distance. So fix r, this term is zero. I'm living at fixed r. Fixed t, this term is zero. So the only line element is the last one. And that means that the displacement is all within this sphere. So the area of a constant r constant t surface equals 4 pi r squared in these coordinates. Okay, because the way you measure the area is just to fix the other coordinates that don't change as you move around the area and calculate the area from the last term, which is just the usual one in Minkowski space. So we say space-time is foliated by spheres of radius 4 pi r squared. And of course, the meaning of A is very clear. The proper time is equal to A, square root of A dt. So we can draw a picture where we have one of these spheres and propagate it forward in time. And this proper time distance is equal to root A dt. Okay, so there's a nice geometrical picture of how you've sliced space-time. And now we just go through the painful part, which is to take this metric and plug it into the equation r mu nu equals zero. So all of you can use Mathematica and just do that, but I will write down the results. And as you'll see, they have very, very strong implications. As it turns out, there's essentially a unique solution. So Karl Schwarzschild, in 1915, so this was very early in the day, more or less as soon as Einstein had come up with his equations, Schwarzschild solved them. And let us denote prime equals d by dr and dot equal d by dt, just to keep the notation simple. And then we have the connection coefficients, a dot over 2a. Easy to see where it comes from. The the Christoffel symbol. Actually, I should tell you, we're going to assume no torsion. So the connection is just the Christoffel symbol. It involves the inverse metric, which gives you a 1 over A, and derivatives of the metric. So that's how you get the A dot. And similarly, gamma T RR equals B dot over 2A gamma T T R is A prime over 2A gamma R T T is A prime over 2B gamma R T R is B dot over 2B gamma R R is B prime over 2B gamma R theta theta is minus R over B and gamma R phi phi is minus R sine theta sine squared theta over B and gamma theta R theta 1 over r gamma theta phi phi minus sine theta cos theta gamma phi r phi is 1 over r and gamma phi phi theta is cot theta. And the others with all others either given by symmetry just because gamma is symmetrical, gamma alpha beta gamma equals gamma alpha gamma beta, or zero. So anything that's not in this list or related by symmetry is zero. Okay, so it's worth trying that just for fun. Plug this into Mathematica and check you get the right expressions. Make sure you understand where they come from. And then compute the Ricci tensor. So this is going to look awful, but I assure you it will simplify. Okay, so just bear with me for a second. Okay, so that is RTT. Let's call that equation one. And then equation two is mercifully shorter. B dot over B times R. And then RRR is a big mess again. So you can check at least all the dimensions of these terms are equal. They're all inverse squares of the coordinates and their derivatives. So we get an A prime. I always get a 1 over R to make up the dimensions. And then finally, we get R phi phi is equal to, sorry, R theta theta is 1 minus 1 over B plus R B prime over B minus R, sorry, it's 1 over R B prime over 2B squared minus R A prime over 2AB. And R phi phi is equal to R theta theta sine squared theta. And all other components are zero. Except I should put here equals RTR, RRT by symmetry. Okay, so those are the wonderful equations which Schwarzschild found. Except Schwarzschild actually made the assumption the metric was independent of T at the beginning. So I'm giving Schwarzschild a little bit more credit than he deserves. It was the mathematician Birkhoff who generalized Schwarzschild to include time dependence. But you notice that the assumption of independent of time is, well, is not too bad, because this equation here, the only simple one, tells you that B must be independent of time. B dot must be zero because R TR is zero. So the coefficient of dr squared has to be independent of time. Solve. And equation two, the easy one, tells you that b dot equals zero. So b equals b of r only. B cannot depend on time. And that being the case, notice that in the rest of the equation, that all these other terms involving time derivatives now disappear. Because if b dot is zero, b double dot is zero, and b dot squared is zero, and a dot b dot is zero, and so all time derivatives disappear. Because the Einstein equation is that R mu nu equals zero. So RTR is certainly zero, but RTR is B dot over B. So B dot must be zero, or B must be infinity. I'm not going to take the case B equals infinity. Okay. Oh, we showed that last time. Remember, the Einstein equations in vacuum read like this, because there's no T mu nu. And then we write this as R mu nu minus 1 half G mu nu R equals 0. And then we take the trace of this looking using G mu nu, and we get R from here. And from here, we get minus 2 R equals 0. And so this tells us that R equals 0. So this equation implies the Ricci scalar is 0. Always true in vacuum. Ricci scalar is zero in vacuum. Okay, so then the full Einstein equation is just that the Ricci tensor must be zero in vacuum. Okay, so B dot is zero and all the time derivatives have gone. That does not mean that things cannot depend on time, by the way. It just means that the time derivatives have disappeared from the equations. We'll have to make another argument to actually remove all the time dependence. So now, take equations 1 and 3. And you notice that if I multiply 3 by A over B, lots of nasty terms cancel, right? Multiply this by A over B and add it to this one. This guy's going to cancel. This guy is going to cancel, right? Because these two are related just by a sign and a factor of A over B. That's probably it. Those are actually the three terms cancel. So let's write that as RTT plus A over B RRR equals, and what I'm saying is that when I do that, this term cancels this. This term cancels that. And this term cancels this. Okay, so all you're left with is adding this one with this one. All the time derivatives have gone. And so you're just left with A prime over B plus B prime times A over B squared. Okay, which is a really nice equation, just involves first derivatives. And furthermore, if I multiply through by B squared, this implies that A prime B plus B prime A, which is just AB prime, equals zero. And so that means that AB is some function of t, because the radial derivative of AB is zero. So the general solution is that AB is any function of t. And so then obviously A is f of t over B. And then A prime over A is minus B prime over B. So now we're going to look at R theta theta, this equation, and eliminate A prime over A. So R theta theta, which must be 0, is, well, R theta theta equals 1 minus 1 over B. And we see from here that A prime over A is equal to B prime over B, so these two terms are equal. So they add, you get rid of the factor of a half, and we get plus R B prime over B. Looks like that should be squared. Squared equals zero. And so this equation is nothing but R over B prime equals 1. Okay, so just work out that R over B prime. It gives you 1 over B, differentiating the R, minus R B prime over B squared. And so that from the equation over here is 1. And so R, this is, so R over B is equal to R integrating plus an arbitrary constant. And you can see this, so I've integrated this equation once. It's the R derivative. And I got a factor of R on the right-hand side. You might have thought this could be an arbitrary function of t. But remember, B dot has to be 0. So be done. So the left-hand side, the left-hand side is independent of t. So that implies, so if I d by dt this, it's zero. So d by dt of the c must be zero. And so where from this guy up here, star c, c dot equals zero. So c is just a constant. Okay, so what we get is that B is R over R plus C, just solving that equation. And so it's equal to 1 over 1 plus C over R, with C a constant. And A is equal to F of T over B, from this formula here. So A is f of t over b. But remember that A comes multiplied by dt squared. So what I have in the metric here is minus dt squared f of t over b, which is only a function of r. So the obvious thing to do is to redefine the time. So let's call this guy dt prime squared, right? I.e. dt prime is integral dt root f of t. And we remove the f. The f turns into 1. So redefine time to remove f. And we get that A is equal to 1 plus C over R. Okay, so what we have shown is that the most general spherically symmetric metric has to be time independent. And has to be given by, almost uniquely, has to be given by this solution, which is defined by just one constant. So we have proven Birkhoff theorem that any spherically symmetric solution of the vacuum Einstein equations must be given up to a coordinate transformation by the Schwarzschild metric. Minus dt squared 1 minus 2gm over rc squared. I'm now just defining this constant c. Plus dr squared over 2 gm over rc squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared. Okay, so let me just talk a little bit about that. You see, what I want is that at large r, when this term becomes small, what I want is to agree with the Newtonian limit h naught naught is equal to 2 phi over c squared, which is minus 2 gm over r c squared. Okay, so that's how I fix this constant c, is by going to large radius, asking what this metric looks like, and the Newtonian limit tells me that it looks like a spherically symmetric mass with a potential phi, which is minus gm over r. So that's the full Schwarzschild metric. So are there any questions? You see, from the derivation, you can see this, the argument is extremely powerful. I mean, for example, if I had an exploding star, and it was spherically symmetric, and it just explodes as violently as it can, but it preserves spherical symmetry, and I'm sitting over here, I will see absolutely no effect of the explosion until the shell hits me. It does not change the metric one iota outside its surface, because outside the matter, you have the vacuum Einstein equations, and you have spherical symmetry, so you have to have the Schwarzschild metric. Yep. Yes. It's not determined. There's one arbitrary constant, C, and you can sort of ask, what is the physical meaning of C, the constant C? The only way really to answer that is to go to infinity and say the metric is flat space at infinity with this 1 over r correction. And then what's the interpretation? Well, basically, if you look at general relativity in asymptotically flat space times, these are space times which approach flat space at infinity, then it turns out there is a conserved quantity, a conserved energy called the ADM energy, Arnowitz Deser Misner energy. And this energy turns out to be nothing but the mass, m. And the correspondence is that the Newtonian, in Newtonian terms, you would call it a mass m. In strictly GR terms, you just say it is the conserved energy corresponding to this solution. So the solution has some energy. I mean, there's an object inside the space-time. It has some energy. The energy is only defined at infinity. It's not. There's no local definition of energy in GR. And the interpretation of this constant is that energy. There's nothing much more you can say about it. So this is analogous, you know, when I solve the Coulomb problem, div E equals zero, I find a 1 over r squared solution for a point charge. It has a source at zero. You know, the electric charge is the source for the electric field. But if I just sit at large r and I say, how much electric charge do I have? Well, I can enclose it in a sphere and say the total charge inside is q. And so the analog here is you go away from the black hole, enclose it in a big sphere. How much mass do I have in there? And you get that by taking the large r limit, integrating over the sphere, and you find this energy m. Okay, so that's the metric. Now you already see it's a pretty peculiar metric, right? Because something really weird is going to happen at smaller radii, which is when r goes small enough, this term will cancel that, one. And so time is going to become a radial variable. Okay, this t coordinate is no longer a time coordinate. inside the black hole. It's a radial coordinate because the coefficient, the eigenvalue corresponding to that coordinate is positive. At exactly the same radius, the radial coordinate, this coefficient flips sign, and r becomes a time coordinate. Now, what that means physically is when you fall across this surface, where this term is zero, if you fall into the black hole, radius becomes time, and marching forward in time is equivalent to marching inward in radius, and you have no option but to go to r equals zero, which is the singularity. So r equals zero, everything goes to hell, and and you hit the singularity. So once you're inside the black hole, there is an upper limit on the amount of time you can spend before you hit the singularity. You cannot resist because radius is time, and you're going forward in time is going decreasing in radius. So it's really very bizarre to go inside the black hole. Let me give you some numbers. We define the Schwarzschild radius. The Schwarzschild radius RS is equal to 2gm over c squared. So this is the radius at which you would cross this funny surface, the horizon of the black hole, called the horizon of the black hole. And this is equal to 3 kilometers for the sun. Okay, so for m equals m sun. So if we took the sun and squished it down to any radius smaller than 3 kilometers, put all its mass into that radius, then it would form a black hole of this radius. I think the Earth is about a centimeter. If we compress the Earth, we get a Schwarzschild radius of about a centimeter. The Milky Way, if we took the whole galaxy, well, the Milky Way galaxy has a black hole of m approximately 4 million m solar at its center. And the Schwarzschild radius is just 4 million times bigger than this, which is about 10 to the 10 meters. Now, there's a very nice coincidence, which is the following. So we've got this black hole in our galaxy. Okay, we live somewhere in this galaxy. And we know the distance to the center. It's this gigantic black hole at the center. It has some radius, the Schwarzschild radius. The angle subtended by this black hole, let's call that d, is the Schwarzschild radius over d. This is about 10 to the 10 meters. The distance to the center of a galaxy is about 8 kiloparsecs, which is 2 times 10 to the 20 meters. And so this angle is about 10 to the minus 10 radians. Okay, so that's the size, the angular size of the black hole on the sky. It's pretty damn small. However, if you take the Earth, and so this is Earth, and cover it in radio telescopes, okay, and make a gigantic radio telescope. So this is the this is called the EHT, or Event Horizon Telescope. Okay, so the idea is just to get all the radio telescopes in the world to cooperate. They all point at this object, and they take data. The size of the Earth is the diameter of the Earth. They're measuring radio waves of some wavelength lambda, and then you know that the diffraction limit, the resolution of the telescope, is just lambda over d. And if we go to millimeter radio waves, millimeter wavelength radio waves, which are gigahertz radio waves, but that's perfectly feasible to use millimeter wavelength radio astronomy. And the diameter of the Earth is 10 to the 7 meters. Okay, that's the diameter is about 10,000 kilometers. So this theta, the resolution of the largest possible radio telescope on Earth, is about 10 to the minus 10. Okay? And that's exactly what you need to make an image of the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. And so that is happening. And in the next 2 or 3 years, Avery Broderick, who is here, is claiming he will produce a picture for you of the black hole and the center of the Milky Way. Okay, of course, all you really see is a dark spot. There's stuff around it. There's some gas and clouds, and hopefully not too dense to stop us actually seeing the extinction created by the black hole. So the black hole is sitting in, you know, in the midst of this swirling cloud of gas, and all we're going to see is a little dark spot indicating the black hole, but we should be able to actually resolve the black hole and see what it is, measure its angular momentum, and so on. So it's actually amazing that how far the field has gone. Even, I guess, 30 years ago, actually I heard a very funny story from Stephen Hawking, which he said the following, that when they proved all kinds of theorems about black holes, he went to France to give lectures about it in the 1970s. And the French astrophysicists hated black holes for a very simple reason, that in French, the name is trou noir, right? I mean, black hole. But that's a very rude word in French, okay? And so the French astrophysicist, oh, I don't want to hear about black holes, you know. And so for some, you know, maybe for that reason, he speculated for that reason, French astrophysicists never took any interest in black holes, and they didn't really believe in them. But but then through the 70s, the evidence began to grow. And when I was a student in the early 80s, many people were still skeptical. I mean, there was some kind of object you could see by its influence on the stars. You saw that, in general, the stars were orbiting faster than they would have if there was no massive object there. I mean, it's a pretty massive object. It's 4 million solar masses. It was having an influence on the star, so you plotted circular velocity versus radius, and you saw the circular velocity growing as you went to smaller radius. So people claim that's evidence for a black hole. We saw quasars, which are extremely powerful sources of radio emissions that people thought they were probably black holes, but very distant in the universe. So gradually the evidence rose. And in the 80s, you know, it just increased and increased. Still, people were a little bit skeptical. They proposed all kinds of alternative models. But by now, it's more or less totally conclusive, and we're actually going to see the thing. And we're going to see that its, you know, its extinction radius equals 2gm over rc squared. And we can measure the mass by the orbiting stars, the stars that pass near it. So it becomes, you know, absolutely conclusive. that there is a black hole. And furthermore, it turns out that almost every galaxy in the universe has a black hole in its center. And even more than that, there seem to be numerous black holes orbiting galaxies, not even in the center, smaller ones which are orbiting. And even more than that, it seems that the black holes played a role in the formation of galaxies. The galaxy mass is 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 solar masses. So the black hole in the center of our galaxy is about 1/1,000,000th the total mass, but which is pretty small. But black holes can emit very powerful bursts of radiation, and in many models of galaxy formation, these are very important in controlling the rate at which galaxies form. So black holes seem to have been very important in the universe. And if you count entropy, the number of states in black holes, actually the entropy in today's universe is dominated by the black holes. So the black holes contain or encode more information than anything else in the universe. So that's very surprising. But the black holes are certainly very important things and very mysterious things. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
Does steam mean you vanish identically away from a massive object, or can there be local stresses in
it? No, it's just by definition. So if Tmu is non-zero, I have matter in space. If Tmu is zero, that's a vacuum solution. There's no matter.
So if you get arbitrarily close to the mass, the solution is still valid?
Ah, no, good point. So this solution is only, of course, valid outside. So let's have some matter which goes out to radius r. And the radius is defined by the area. So I've got some mass who has an area 4 pi r squared. Outside here, I have to have Schwarzschild. Okay. Now imagine this mass is collapsing. So in fact, possibly it begins outside the Schwarzschild radius. And then radius starts to shrink. So you have Schwarzschild outside until the point where the mass falls inside this radius. And then you have the black hole. Here's RS. Okay. You still have Schwarzschild everywhere outside this mass. The mass may continue to collapse. And in fact, it has to, because r becomes time. And so basically, the mass collapses to the singularity. And you just have Schwarzschild everywhere. OK, so there is no way of resisting this. Sure. So no. When we study the interior of the black hole, we will see explicitly where this mass resides. Okay, and it does change the metric, but only near the singularity. It affects the precise nature of the singularity. But as I said, there's really, once the mass is inside its Schwarzschild radius, there's no stopping it collapsing. As long as it has spherical symmetry. If you avoid spherical symmetry, you can play all sorts of games, but still there's no way to avoid the singularity. And we really don't know what happens at the singularity. We don't know if that leads somewhere or if it's the end of space-time. Yeah?
There's something inside the Schwarzschild radius of the singularity in finite proper time or finite?
Proper time. Yeah, finite proper time.
And also finite.
The time it takes is, I think, a factor of pi, but it's basically the time is the Schwarzschild radius over C. The proper time it takes after you cross the Schwarzschild radius to hit the singularity is just the naive time, up to a factor of pi. You can't stop falling. Right. Oh, well, the idea behind general relativity is that what matters is the geometry, not the coordinates. So in any given geometry, I can put any number of coordinates. The coordinates I choose are just the lines of constant x, y, z, t, and I can pick those to be anything. So the whole idea of general relativity is that we don't care about the coordinates. Even though we use them to do calculations, we know they're not fundamental, and in fact, they're meaningless. They tell us how to describe the geometry in a given coordinate system. If we do changes of coordinates, that should not change anything physical. That's the whole idea behind general relativity, that the coordinates are just a tool we use to study a given geometry. So if you produce another metric by a coordinate transformation, I'll say, you know, a big yawn, I'll say, well, that's just Schwarzschild in another coordinate system. But for me, if I'm a physicist, it's the same metric. Metrics which are related by coordinate changes are the same metric. Nothing physical changes. Yep.
You said if the size of the star is smaller than the structure, it shows radius, like classes, it's
similarity. Yes.
The star is made out of matter, so it is composed of fermions, so how can we?
Yeah, even the pressure from the fermions is not enough to resist gravity.
But, like, how about the atomic collision?
Yeah, it's true. Well, space itself is collapsing. So, the Pauli exclusion principle doesn't help you. That the actual volume of space is shrinking to zero. And, you know, I say that, but also there are some interesting effects, which I mentioned in previous lectures, which is that there are effects due to torsion, which are ignored in this argument, and due to the spin density, which is created by fermions. And it seems those effects can actually resist the contraction. So this is something I'm very interested in. But in the conventional picture with zero torsion, there is no way to stop the collapse. As far as we know. Okay, so I'll see you tomorrow. Is there a class this afternoon? What time? 2? Okay, great. It's not the memory one, is it? Oh, you did the memory one. Ah, how did you find it? Was it okay? Okay. Very confusing? Yeah. Yeah, there are several contributions. One is linear, and you can derive it in linear theory. The nonlinear term is more complicated, and different people describe it differently in the literature. The person who discovered it is a guy called Christodoulou, who is very mathematical and writes huge books, 600-page books, which are almost impossible to read. And so it has taken people a while to understand what he is saying, because his terminology is, his methods are very mathematical and very, only very few people understand them. Okay, so Christodoulou claimed that there is this nonlinear memory effect. And then other people like Kip Thorne, who's been studying gravitational waves for a long time, published a paper saying, yes, we missed that effect, but it has a simple physical interpretation. Okay. And what, roughly speaking, what Thorne is saying is the following, at least as far as I understand it, is, you know, if you just look at the potential created by some mass, this goes like, I guess this, maybe with a G, if I'm at radius R. Now imagine this mass explodes. Okay, so it explodes, and imagine it's into massless radiation, like photons or neutrinos, gravitational waves. They come out, and they leave the source. So this M has exploded. But I'm only going to see this metric perturbation until that shell of massless stuff passes me. Okay, so M is going to go from some value to some other value as a function of time, of my time. Right? I'm going to see the initial mass, which is big, and then it will drop because this stuff has passed me. And only the M, the mass inside my radius, counts. Okay? So this is obviously causes H to go from one value to another value. And that's an example of the memory effect. And what Thorne's claim is that the nonlinear memory effect is nothing but the emission of energy in gravity waves. And if you count the effect of that emission on the mass of the object inside, that changes H by the step function. So that's Thorne's claim. I don't know if it's really true. I don't know if Christodoulou agrees with that. Certainly not what Christodoulou says in his papers. So, there is a mathematical derivation of it, which includes nonlinear GR. You have to do nonlinear GR if you want to really include this, the propagation of mass outwards and the effect on the mass of the star, because the energy in gravitational waves is a nonlinear effect. So Christodoulou claims he's done that all properly and he knows exactly what happens. Thorne says there's a simple interpretation. But the final conclusion, I mean, at least if you read the current research papers, the final conclusion is to actually calculate this jump in H, you know, the change in H, to calculate that, you have to solve the full Einstein equations numerically, and it's pretty complicated. So it seems to be one of the more difficult things to compute on this memory change. I don't really know much more than that. But there is a prospect of measuring it. I mean, it's a large enough effect, you should be able to measure it. 10 years or 20 years from now, we should be able to measure this nonlinear gravitational memory effect. Yeah. Let me talk about that after I talk about the black holes.